The version of roots music that I got absorbed into as a collegiate and then the years since was very driven by this holistic view. And I don't know who set me up to see it this way. I don't know where I got it, but of course, you know, you're reading liner notes, I'm reading books, I'm listening to the Grateful Dead cover, Lead Belly, or many, I saw and felt this giant historic conversation that looked forward and back in time, that looked across race. Certainly I learned the story of the rank commercial appropriation, and then later on you see really a remarkable examples of American roots music being one of the most authoritative and energizing frontiers of racial reconciliation and integration in America. So you've got this really mix of forces. You've got to tease out in your role, it'd be very interesting to try to tease out what was appropriation that was noble and right and came from a place of deep appreciation and mutual understanding and equivalence. What was in fact the wrong kind of cultural appropriation? Any thoughts on that broadly?
Yeah, I think to me, even aside from the ideological complications involved in something like cultural appropriation, which is, I know, still a very controversial idea for a lot of people, to me, it's all about the flow of resources, right? Where if I'm taking music from somebody or learning from somebody, one, I'm going to pay them for teaching it to me. Two, I'm going to credit them when I perform that piece. I'm going to talk about issues their community might be facing, right? I will talk about the labor and environmental exploitation of Appalachia. I will talk about what Gullah Geechee communities are having to do to prepare for climate change in their ancestral lands. There's a level of investment and return to those communities that I think is necessary when you take somebody else's music. And when it comes to something that is as commercially successful as country music or even as bluegrass, let alone rock and roll, rap, whatever, if you are Elvis Presley or whoever else, who of course is a terrible example because he just straight up stole music from black people, and did not pay them royalties for it, you should be donating money back to black causes. You should be promoting black artists and black causes actively with the platform that you've been given, right? Every time Black Lives Matter flares up, I feel like there's a large portion of the black artist community going, okay, so where are all these white rappers right now? You know? They're not speaking up on, you know, we don't really want people speaking on our behalf, but are they speaking in support of us? Mm-hmm. Are they donating to bail funds? And some of them do it. And that to me, I'm like, okay, I have nothing to say to you. You know, if you're down, you're down, and that's cool. But I do think that when it comes to evaluating the specific impacts individuals have had, whether or not they're redirecting part of their profit back into the other communities that they have learned or taken music from is a really important thing to me. It's all well and good to have the best of intentions, but at the end of the day, black people need to get paid. And the fact that between blackface minstrelsy, rock and roll, arguably like electronic and disco music, and rap, we have generated every major musical export this country has ever had and seen pennies of the payout. Of course, all artists see pennies of the payout, but that's a different issue entirely. That to me speaks to there being a broad pattern. And on each individual basis, I would be saying, are these artists looking for ways that they can redirect the material resources they have gained by using a black art form into the black community? That's something I think about all the time, and I like barely have money right now because we're in a pandemic. And, you know, I'm thinking about, can I donate to someone? Is there a way I can take a portion of my album sales and put them toward this cause? And that's not something I'm financially in a position to do in the near future, but I would hope that if I wind up in that position, I would do it. And I would hope that other musicians who may be artistically or culturally indebted to an underprivileged minority group would also take the same opportunity. It's the least we can do.
You've got me thinking about black music historically in America as a kind of open source software, except they were never given the choice to patent it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And there, maybe there's something there to develop. Roots music has an interesting situation in that it is highly institutionalized. It's got associations. It's got Folk Alliance, the Bluegrass Association, the Americana Music Association, and the Blues Foundation. And they talk amongst themselves and they work on common projects, and more than ever, I think. And each of them in their own way have moved forward with an agenda of inclusion and diversification, which has taken different shapes in each of the associations. What do you see going on there?
I think, so I'm only dipping my toe into the world of the industry conferences and all of that. I will say I've been to IBMA, the World of Bluegrass Conference, 3 years now, perhaps two, I think three though. And I was a member of their Leadership Bluegrass class this year.
Great.
So I've had some chance to get to know that organization and get to know the people who are involved in making things happen there. I've been really impressed by the folks that I've been working with. You know, I've been involved with institutions of one flavor or another as an activist and an artist for my whole life, whether that be the school I went to, my college, etc. I have felt listened to by IBMA. Do they do exactly what I would want every single time? No. They also have to represent a lot of people who aren't me. So I understand that. And, you know, we're all going to keep pushing for what we want to see. I've been really impressed by their understanding of their place as a cultural institution in this moment to widen the tent of bluegrass to include not only just other musical styles like old time and country that overlap so much and yet were not welcome for so long, but also the many different types of people who can play that, and to foreground those conversations even when it's not always easy. I do think there is more room for, across the board, not at IBMA specifically, more people of color to be in leadership positions, right? You look at the governing boards of a lot of these organizations, it's a lot of older white folks who did a lot of the work to put these systems in place. And I know, especially in the case of Folk Alliance, we're like involved in doing the hard work on the streets back in the day. I'm not trying to diminish what they have contributed at all, but I also am excited to see potential for more queer people, more trans people, more women, and more people of color to be included in those leadership bodies. I think once the leadership diversifies, you will see a trickle-down effect and the industry will diversify. And it kind of has to happen in both directions, right? There has to be someone making the way in from the bottom, making it up to the top, and then bringing it back down. It takes there being someone to be the pioneer. And I think we're really lucky to have folks like Rhiannon Giddens who did that for so many people my age. We had someone to look at and say, that could be me.
How do you think the story of the Carolina Chocolate Drops is going to get told? Well, it's an amazing tale.
It is. I mean, you know, it's hard to say 20, 30, 50 years down the line what folks are going to say. I say they single-handedly snatched the black string band tradition from the jaws of extinction, right? There were other black musicians who were playing string band instruments at the time. Sule Gregg Wilson, Earl White, Tony Thomas. There were folks out there making the music, but for them to go learn the style of Joe and Odell Thompson as well as they did, these are, you know, two older black folks from Mebane, North Carolina, who grew up in the tradition, who learned from other black folks, played for other black folks. They were able to take that style, take it worldwide, and bring old time music, let alone black old time music, to a larger stage than it's maybe ever seen before. That's a huge deal. And I don't know a single black person my age or who came to the music around the time that I did who does not at least partially credit the Carolina Chocolate Drops for making them feel like they could do it and they were welcome. That to me just speaks volumes. I had a really great moment. A few, gosh, was it just last fall? Last fall, at this event called the Afro-Latchen On Time Music Gathering that Dr. Dina Jennings runs in Orange, Virginia. And it's sort of a gathering of a lot of folks who are working in Black roots music, blues, country, old time, bluegrass, whatever. And Rhiannon surprised us all by like flying in from the Americana Awards. Like she had her Americana Award and like a little tote bag. Yeah. And of course hadn't slept in like 4 days and was just like, hi. But she had a really moving moment, at least for me to witness, when she just took a step back and went, I can't believe there are people I don't know here.
Yeah.
Of, you know, there being enough Black folks making the music now that we don't all know each other by name and face.
Yeah.
And we want to have the community, of course, but I think that just speaks to the exponential growth in our population within the music and in the industry since the Chocolate Drops came out front and made the way for us.
That's very interesting. I've been intimately involved in IBMA and Americana for 20 years now. And one would imagine that the bluegrass community would have a taller ladder to climb, given that it still has a huge fan base and musician base that are very rooted in conservative Southern and sort of kind of conservative mindset America. Whereas Americana is full of, it's a very, you know, the people there, the musicians and the producers and the community is pretty liberal, but sort of like moderate liberal, like me who 5 years ago really didn't know what we didn't know about what had been written and thought and said about race, about the African-American journey. These last 5 years, I've learned more about that subject than any other subject, and I can't think of a more interesting subject. And my background is in policy and politics, and I covered Capitol Hill for a while. And I love civic conversation and civic life and how that plays out. But it's been something to try to get on this train and get up to speed and to watch Americana do what they could do in their forum. But that it struck me was because I was on the submission committee for the showcases for years. And all the time I'm thinking I would love to have more inclusion in this at our showcase in the fall, and they're not applying. Now there's certain people we can reach out to, but like you said, 5-6 years ago, it was a handful of artists, or if that, it was hard to find them. And that has been, but they reached out in terms of the Lifetime Achievement Awards. They brought Solomon Burke in to celebrate him and Mavis Staples to celebrate her and William Bell, and shone a light and told stories that were really pretty, they were emotional and overwhelming. And then you get last year a kind of climactic moment when the award show at the Ryman is opened with the our Native Daughters and Amethyst singing, you know, leading the song of I'm Black Myself. And it was something else. I'm getting chills just now. And there's been a real journey. It's the middle of a journey, but I mean, it's one that is so exciting for the ultimate values that everybody was talking about in the music prior to all this, you know, authenticity, telling a story that's real, meaningful, and honest. Truly music brings us together and connects us, you know. You can live that as a cliche and roll along, but these last 5 years have struck me as a time when it occurred to many how hard that really is, and what the beginnings of what it takes. So I don't know. I don't mean to go on a soliloquy here, but it's important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've definitely been really excited by what I've seen coming out of the Americana scene and the country scene and everything else. I mean, one of the top albums of the past year for me has been Yola's album, Walk Through Fire. Yeah. in addition to, of course, our native daughters, which I feel Rhiannon like sent me a selfie from the studio when they were making that album, and I immediately lost my mind. I was like, can I buy it now? Like, I'm ready.
And her words really, something she said something about that project in the context of that project that really stuck with me. And she talked about spreading the power around that I've been given. Using my momentary, you know, this place where I've earned this privilege or been given this privilege to be seen. And my first thought is, who can I bring to share that spotlight? And I was like, that is news I can use.
She is the best at that. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I feel like really sets her apart from so many of the other artists on her level is I met her 5 years ago, I guess, at the Augusta Heritage Center. She and hubby Jenkins taught a week-long class on Black string band music there, and I took it. And I mean, she's obviously got a lot on the go, so it's not like we were in touch all the time, but she remembered me from that point on and would check in and see how things were going. And when Reparations came out and she heard it and she heard that Tatiana Hargraves and I were touring that stuff around, she wrote me a random Facebook message and was just like, how would you like to come open some shows? And it was totally out of nowhere. And we did it. It was like, it was an incredible experience. Getting to play stages of that size. I mean, Tatiana had done it all before because she's incredible and more experienced than me. It was my first time being in that role and having that opportunity. And Rhiannon has just every step of the way been so willing to make herself available and to use her platform to amplify other artists who don't have one that's the same size. It's just like constantly a reminder of like, what can I aim for if I ever get to that level? Who do I want to be like? And I think there are a lot of artists who, particularly in minority groups, will get to the top and sort of kick down the ladder because they want to be that person, right? You know, you can get tokenized and get a lot of gigs that way, and it doesn't bother some people the way it does others. And I'm not going to say whether they should feel that way about it or not, but as an artist who's trying to make a way in it, it was so much easier to have someone like Rhiannon there to not only have paved the way in the broad sense, but also to help guide so many of us who were trying to follow in those footsteps. She really invests so heavily in the community and in other artists. I just like want that to come back to her all the way.
As you look out the window in this extraordinary year and you've watched the Black Lives Matter fire rise up again, and maybe with more staying power and more ferocity and consequence than ever before. What's the summary of what you're seeing? And is there a musical story that can be better told or more clearly told, or a role that you feel has shifted as your activism and your music have fused and suddenly there's a cultural moment and a political moment to live?
Well, it was striking for me that Spider Tales officially came out minutes after the police precinct in Minneapolis burned. And so much of what I was trying to do of that album was to go back through those old traditional recordings and say that this exact thing was going to happen and say this has been simmering beneath the surface for so long and you only don't know it because you aren't looking. And to bring out those common threads of the anger and the resentment and the grief that are now pouring out in the streets. I feel like I couldn't have timed the album better to have that message be understood and heard by so many people. And I'm hopeful that it provides somebody with a way in who maybe didn't understand where folks were coming from before. At the same time, I don't know. It's hard to have faith in change right now, I think. But it's definitely been a stressful few months. And I think that every artist should be thinking about how we can use our platform right now to address the deeply intersecting topics of the pandemic and Black Lives Matter. Because even as I agree, we need to have a very timely and important conversation, overdue conversation, really, about police violence and black communities. COVID-19 is also disproportionately killing black people in numbers far higher than police are. That is also a emergency issue of racism, and it should be dealt with as such.
There's so many opportunities to think about the difference between the late 60s and now. We have a new civil rights movement, one of deeper, harder questions. Then music was like the soundtrack. It was woven in at the highest levels of culture and on the radio. The average person on the street understood the message of Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and the Staple Singers, and music was a fuel and a balm for this, literally for the marchers in civil rights. I don't feel like now music has as much of a, has found its role yet. I see stray songs by artists who care, but the cultural weight of any given artist or music now, it means a lot to certain communities of music fans and music freaks. But to the larger culture, I'm really missing something, and I feel like it's an emotional, political fuel that is yet to be really brought to bear.
I think that's fair in some senses, but at the same time, I do think there are a lot of artists who are taking a stand in some way. I think a lot of it is happening, as you said about my album earlier, it's showing rather than telling, right? So, you know, Beyonce just put out Black is King. I'm not going to pretend I watched the whole thing. I've like never been a Beyonce stan, but I appreciate the way that she's using her platform right now. There's a lot of music that's just come out dealing with this. Do I think it's necessarily going to be the chart topping hits? I do not. Part of that is because, right, we're in like a global era, and a lot of the folks who are consuming American music are not from here, and we can't expect our domestic issues to rule what everyone else buys. But at the same time, I do think that we're in an era where there are pop stars who are choosing to embody what they feel freedom would look like rather than lamenting where we are. I don't think I ever feel as like empowered and ready to take stuff on when I listen to Pete Seeger as I do when I listen to Lizzo. And Lizzo's not writing a song about George Floyd, but she's writing a song about her and what she wants for herself.
Yeah.
And that to me is such a powerful statement. And I think even on a, you know, arguably more crass or whatever level, like WAP just came out, right? This Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion song. I don't know if you're supposed to spell it out, WAP. I'm not going to pretend I'm hip. But at the end of the day, right, there are artists who are really pushing the envelope and are getting pushback for not acting the way they're supposed to as women and as black women. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it's black women who are leading this charge. And I will say, I think there are like black men in positions of power who could step up right now. And again, all the white artists who are making money off our stuff and aren't using it in ways that are helpful to us, I think we have a problem and we need to discuss it. But I do think that there is a role for today's pop music. I don't think it was going to look like the protest music of the 60s, because we're not in the 60s anymore. And a lot of those songs, I don't think have great staying power for my generation because they're so issue specific and explicit about it. Whereas there are songs from the same time period, songs from a little bit later, songs from 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, where obviously nobody knew what was coming, but I can listen to it and say, wow, this is like what I needed right now, right? I came back to the 2007 Nine Inch Nails album, Year Zero, last fall. I was like, Trent Reznor wrote an album about the Trump presidency in 2007. No one knew this was going to happen, but the album exists. And I think we just have to get a little bit past the idea of, if I'm not hitting you with a 2x4, I don't care. I think that folks are trying to find ways to engage with the politics and with the moment, and also engage with the art as a thing unto itself that deserves its own respect and vision.
Jake Blount, thank you for your time and great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.